It was the dawn of the third age of podcasting, 30 years after the series had launched.
The Babylon Podcast was a dream given form. Its goal, to discuss the place where humans and aliens could work out their differences peacefully.
It's a port of call, home away from home for established fans, newbies, John, Blaine, and guests.
Humans and aliens wrapped in 2,500,000 tons of spinning metal, all alone in the night.
It could be a dangerous place.
Wait, what?
But it's our last, best hope for peace.
This is the story of the last of the Babylon stations.
The year is 2024.
The name of the podcast is...
Babylon 5, 30 years later.
Hello and welcome back to Babylon 5, 30 years later. A podcast where we are taking a look at every episode of Babylon 5, 30 years after its original release. My name is John Wilson, and with me is my good friend and partner on this, the man who has put a hole in my mind. Blaine, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How about you, John?
This reminds me of that time when you tried to drill a hole in your head. I know that would have worked if I hadn't stopped you.
I was going to be able to finish the quote, by the way.
I didn't think you would. I should have just let you try. I'm so sorry. I figured I was pulling like a really, really obscure line out.
If it's Ghostbusters, I can quote it.
Okay.
My cousin and I went to a Ghostbusters quote-along thing at the movies, and we couldn't figure out why we were the only two quoting along with the movie for the first 20 minutes. And then they stopped the movie, came out and apologized, and turned the subtitles on, and we're going, oh, wait, everyone else needed help?
I apologize for my lack of faith in you there, Blaine. Well, today we are talking about the big mid-season episode, And the Sky Full of Stars, which led to their first broadcast break. So it's kind of, you know, nowadays the mid-season finale is a whole thing. And this basically serves the same dramatic purpose.
It is, yes. It is one of the bigger ones for the season. At least it feels that way the first time that you watch it.
Yeah, that's true. And there's another broadcast break after TKO, even longer than this broadcast break is going to be. But I have no idea what TKO is or how big it is, because as I have said before, after this episode, I know nothing. This is the last one that I had seen before in a previous attempt to watch this series. Actually, I don't know nothing. I know that one particular cast member doesn't come back next season, but I'm not going to say who that is.
Yeah, that was accidentally slipped by a previous guest, but edited out of our podcast release because we do like to be first-time viewer-friendly.
First-time viewer-friendly. So, yeah, And the Sky Full of Stars. We have the director is Janet Greek. Now, this is our first time to hear her name in this show, but you said that she is going to come back.
Yes, this is the first of 12 episodes of Babylon 5 she's directed. She also does the River of Souls TV movie and 2 episodes of Crusade.
All right.
So we'll actually see 15 directorial edits or efforts from her. And going through her IMDb at this point, her directorial debut was directing the Ricky music video for Weird Al Yankovic.
Everyone knows that video.
Yeah. Then 3 episodes of St. Elsewhere, The Ladies Club, a couple of L.A. Law, a couple episodes of Max Headroom.
Looks like several episodes of Melrose Place.
Yeah, we've got a few here. So 5 episodes of Melrose. We don't know. Actually, the first episode of Melrose Place would have been prior to Babylon 5.
So she was doing that while she was doing this.
Yeah, she did Melrose Place from 92 to 97 and Babylon 5 from 94 to 98.
Actually, it looks like a lot of her directing credits were during these 90s years. So while she was doing Babylon 5, she was going around doing lots of directing at places. But her Babylon 5 and Crusade credits are her last. So she chose another career or something else after 1999.
Yes, and just one other thing I want to highlight here, because it may not stand out for John just checking the IMDb here. But of these 12 episodes of Babylon 5, not only do we have a few season finales and season premieres, but Babylon 5, the way that they structure it, they kind of have a theme for the season. So when they start writing the season, there's going to be 22 different episode titles. And then one of those episodes gets renamed for the theme of the season. She has directed 3 of those.
So that episode for this season is Signs and Portents, is that right?
That's right, yes.
Okay.
So that one, when they were talking about it and planning it, it was titled Raiding Party. And then they said, no, this is the one that fits the season.
Okay, so that's going to be kind of our touchstone episode when we get there, which is still a little ways away. No, lies. Lies on top of lies. We're only 5 episodes from Signs and Portents.
Yep.
All right. And then the writer for this episode, this is one of the few episodes for the series that is written by J. Michael Straczynski, one of the, 95% of the show that he writes?
Yeah, 92 of 110 episodes, 111 if you count The Gathering, but then he's at 93 out of 111 if you count that.
So yeah, he wrote most of the show, and this being a key episode is definitely going to be one that he puts his pen to.
Yeah, the plan when he was doing season one was to have 50% in-house scripts and 50% freelancers, and he would do all the heart arc-heavy episodes. And there will come a time we'll discuss when he realized that, you know, at this point, the entire season is going to be arc-heavy. So that's me.
That's me. Just got to get to writing.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, anything else before we get into the details of the episode?
No, let's get into the synopsis. Everything else is best held until after that.
So this was, of course, broadcast on March 16th, 1994, which you can tell because it's coming out on March 16th, 2024, as is evident in your podcatcher notes, or if you're listening to this on the day of release. It's a pretty straightforward plot. Most of the details and intricacies of the plot come out in dialogue and revelations, which we will explore more in our discussion. But basically, we have two sinister individuals coming on board the station that are never given names. They're just Night One and Night Two. They're not even called that on screen. That's just their credited character names. And as it turns out, Night Two is going to be the more prevalent character of the two. They have taken advantage of a crew member or officer named Benson, who has gotten himself into some gambling debts, and they've taken advantage of him by promising some money if he betrays his trust as a Babylon 5 officer and gives them a power pod, a very powerful, portable source of power, which they then take for nefarious, mysterious purposes. Sort of a side note along the way, we see a scene where Dr. Franklin is examining Delenn just to have a baseline of Minbari physiology, because this is not a sci-fi TV show where everything about every alien is automatically known by the computer. The commander, Commander Sinclair, has some bad dreams about the last fight of the Minbari War, where he led a squad of, they're called Furies, Fury Fighters, against the Minbari fleet.
Yeah, the Star Furies.
The Star Furies, that's what they're called.
Battle of the Line.
I don't know why I can't remember that, but yeah, the Battle of the Line. And in that battle, one of his pilots, one of his friends, was killed, named Mitchell. And it kind of focuses on their dialogue a little bit for reasons that'll become important later. And he wakes up from the dream, and the station is completely abandoned. He wanders around. He can't find anybody. The computer at first doesn't respond, and then tells him that there is one other life form on board, tells him the location. He goes down there and tries to find them. Now, we go to a commercial break and come back to see Garibaldi and Delenn on the station. So we immediately find out that there is a disconnect going on. They can't locate the commander, and they begin a search. Back in Sinclair's situation, he comes face to face with Night Two, who basically spends a lot of the rest of the episode ranting and raving at Sinclair, because Sinclair, he was at the Battle of the Line, he blacked out. 24 hours later, the Minbari had surrendered, and Night Two believes that Sinclair betrayed them, that Sinclair is lying about having blacked out, that somehow he and the Minbari colluded, and he gave Earth away to the aliens, basically. It's a lot more of it's not as hatefully bigoted, it's just more like, you made us lose the war to these others, kind of bigoted. In any case, lots of ranting, lots of back and forth between them. This is all in a sort of virtual reality setup. We see what it really looks like, which is Commander Sinclair strapped to a chair, all of these electronics tied to him, and two like needles shooting sparks into both of his eyes to make him see what they want him to see. Knight 2 is hooked up to a similar setup, except that the electricity is only going into one of his eyes, allowing him to still partially interact with the real world around him, which is helpful whenever Benson, the officer that they took advantage of, stumbles upon their shenanigans, and he's like, yeah, kill that guy. And so Knight 1 kills that guy. Back in the virtual reality setup, at first Sinclair is adamant. He didn't lie. He did black out. He knows nothing about what really happened. But then he remembers. He remembers that scene from The Gathering where the Minbari agent who tried to kill Ambassador Kosh told him that there's a hole in your mind. And that sparks some more memories that he had hidden or covered up or maybe just were removed from his mind, but now he can access them again, of being taken aboard the Minbari cruiser, being imprisoned, being interrogated, being tortured, and being surrounded by multiple gray cloaked and hooded figures whom we immediately think is this the Gray Council, because we've heard of these people before. And at one point, he's able to get free of his bonds and he takes the hood off of one of the Gray Council members and sees a face that now, looking back, he recognizes as Ambassador Delenn. So there's more going on here than meets the eye. We don't know exactly what yet, but we'll talk about that in a minute. At one point, he's able to get free of his bonds from the virtual reality chair, and he's able to give a really good punch to the face to Knight 2, and then he uses his gun to shoot Knight 1, and he gets free. For a little while, all of the drugs and stuff that they used for the virtual reality are still in his system, and he thinks he's aboard the Minbari cruiser, so there's a little bit of a hunt and chase while he's out of sorts trying to kill Babylon 5 people because he thinks that they're, you know, abductors. Eventually, Ambassador Delenn confronts him and is able to talk him down and calm him down, telling him that she is his friend. She is his friend, Ambassador Delenn, and even though he still remembers decloaking her, he comes out of it long enough for them to get him to medical treatment. Everything wraps up with the surviving Knight being taken off to trial on Earth, because evidently he's part of a larger group on Earth that is trying to prove collusion between Earth governmental and Minbari governmental people. So he's going to be taken back for trial for that. And Sinclair's like, I want to see him before we go. So they go down to the shuttle bay where he's being loaded up. Sinclair confronts him, but it is evident that through the shenanigans of being, you know, forcibly separated from the virtual reality or whatever, something really, really bad happened to his mind. He seems not even barely, he's not lucid, he's not coherent, he's barely able to interact with reality, but he does recognize Commander Sinclair, and he's like, maybe we're still inside, and no one really knows what to make of that. He gets hauled off. Sinclair and Delenn have a brief conversation where Delenn asks if he remembers anything, and we see that Sinclair very much definitely does remember seeing Delenn, but he tells her that no, he remembers nothing. And then he goes and makes a captain's log entry where, I guess it'd be commander's log or station log, where he remembers everything and wonders, was this the Gray Council? What could it all mean? And Delenn is confronted by a Gray Council member and told that if Sinclair proves dangerous, he's going to have to be killed. And that's the end of In the Sky Full of Stars. We go on break for a month after that. Did I miss anything?
I think those are the key points in terms of the summary of this episode. There's a couple things, obviously, I'm going to have to call up in giving form to the dream.
Right.
Some of which are obvious, some of which are not. I think the one element that makes sense, or that we should draw attention to, is that Benson, the one who was compromised, he had been taken off active duty by Sinclair and Garibaldi pending an investigation. And Garibaldi's aide restored him to active duty by saying, no, we checked the records, everything's fine. And then when Garibaldi rechecks it, he sees, yeah, there's a lot there. And there's some detail in that record that you'd think should have flagged for the aide.
unless the aide intentionally ignored it. Is that what you're implying?
Either incompetent or colluding. I'm not going to say which.
Okay. So there's a question raised. Why did he bring him back to active duty after all this? Okay, that is definitely a question mark. I really like this one. I feel like this book ends with the gathering very, very nicely. And feels like a mystery that got introduced at the beginning, we're coming back to it. So it's like, oh, okay, big stuff is moving and shaking here.
It's also a bit of a landmark. So you said that you really like this one, correct? Mm-hmm. When we were discussing, I believe it was Parliament of Dreams, I had mentioned that up to this point, we had yet to see an episode where the IMDb user scores rated them as above average for the series. This is the first that rates as above average for the series.
Ah.
The average IMDb user score for the series is 7.846, and this one clocks in at 7.9 out of 10.
So when you say above average, you mean above average for the episode ratings for this show, not for some randomly chosen this is average rating. Gotcha.
Right. Yes. It's only in the context of The Gathering plus the 110 regular episodes of Babylon 5 that we're talking here.
Now, just a question. Is that average score, that 7.846, is that displayed on MDIB somewhere, or did you tabulate all the scores?
I tabulated.
Okay.
What the IMDb displays for the overall series score is not the average episode scores. You can log into IMDb and rate individual episodes or the series as a whole.
Okay.
So the series as a whole will often have a higher rating than the individual episodes. So, and I pulled out the movies because they're often not representative. They, you know, people who are not regulars of the series will rate it. So it's not that that makes those ratings inaccurate. It means that it's being rated by a different population, because the people who hated the first season aren't rating the last season in most cases.
So just out there and listen on that, if you're watching this show along with us for the first time and you've been less than impressed with everything so far, well, everything so far has been in the lower half of the ratings. And now this is our first one that's even just tipping. It sounds like 7.846, 7.9. This is just scraping the upper half of the season, of the series.
The Z score on this one, statistically speaking, the Z score is a measure of how far away from the average you are relative to the standard deviation. So 68% of the content will have a Z score between positive and negative 1. So the further your Z score is from 0, the further you are away from average in that direction, according to how variable that series is. The Z score in this episode is 0.068.
Okay, so a very, very tiny bit above average. A lot of it's going to be far above that.
Yeah, this is, you know, for all practical purposes, this is an average quality episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And when you get to the extreme above averages, we've got a couple episodes that clock in at 9.6 out of 10 coming up.
Wow.
Not in season one. The season one average in isolation is about a 7.2.
So we're way above average for season one. We're only slightly above average for the entire show.
Yeah. Season one actually has the lowest average rating of all the seasons. From there, it's 7.7. And season four, I think, is about an 8.3.
Okay. Okay. All righty. So, wow, there was a lot in this. It doesn't start out feeling like a lore episode, even though this turns out to be very, very much a lore episode, because you've got, you know, you got people on the station who aren't supposed to be there. You've got a guy who's been gambling, who's, you know, giving stuff away to other people. In fact, Benson gets called on the carpet before Sinclair and Garibaldi for his gambling. And I thought it was just kind of neat to find out that, like, they have policies in place that officers are supposed to adhere to, because gambling can lead to some very bad choices that put people at risk for their health and safety. And you can't have that with officers. So there are strict policies in place. And Benson has been doing a lot of off-the-books gambling and been racking up a lot of debts, which is why all of this is able to take place in the first place.
Yeah, he was the inn that they found. Is there? The restrictions are never gamble on duty, and off-duty gambling is limited to 50 credits per week. And apparently he was exceeding both of those restrictions.
There was a really good bit, because after that conversation, whenever Benson leaves, Garibaldi's like, he was lying. And Sinclair had a line I really liked about lying. He said, everybody lies. The innocent lie, because they don't want to be blamed. The guilty lie because they don't want to get caught. And just that idea that everybody lies is something that I don't feel like it's talked about a lot. I mean, most of us probably make it a point to tell the truth like almost 100% of the time. But I would think that like almost everybody fails 100% at least somewhere along the way. And usually it's because of a good self-preservation reason. But yeah.
Yeah, it's something that, like you said, everyone aspires to 100%. But then if you get a three-year-old asking you if Santa's real.
Don't lie to the three-year-old. Don't tell them Santa's real.
Yeah, it's tough. I had to walk that line with one of my younger cousins once. And
oh, yeah.
Thankfully, he didn't say Santa real. He said, do you believe in Santa? And I just answered questions with questions and said, well, why, you know, why wouldn't I? Setting up as a question. Like, you know, you could convince me not to. He chose to take that as affirmation. So I found that answering a question with a question was more avoiding the question, more lying, but letting him draw the conclusion he wanted to draw.
And when you have stuff like that where other parents can feel very prickly about the choices being made, it's good to find a strategy that preserves your integrity, but also preserves their parenting choices. So the conversation between Delenn and Franklin, after he examines her, you know, they're just, it seems like they're just making conversation. And the war comes up, the Earthman-Bari War. And I don't know that we get a duration for this, because we always talk about how it ended 10 years ago, but I don't know if it was like 3 months long, 5 years long, whatever. But his life before the war, he definitely had, part of his career existed before the war. And even though he's a young man, that, you know. But anyways, where I was going is that she asks him, what did you do during the war? Because he says he did eventually get involved toward the end. They asked him to turn over his notes on Minbari physiology so that they could develop ways, or see if there are ways to develop biological weapons against the Minbari. And the acting from Delenn's actress is really great, because there's just the subtlest of shift in her expression. It becomes slightly accusatory, slightly suspicious. And she's like, did you? Did you turn them over? And Franklin, being the absolute cinnamon roll that he is like, no. I burned all of my notes rather than have them used for something like that. So that was pretty great.
Yes. And to answer another question, even though we don't have the time frame on screen yet, I checked the chronology books while you were talking here. The Earth-Minbari War ran from 2245 to 2248.
Okay, so 3 years is definitely a war, but it's not like a large chunk of an adult's time, lifetime.
Yeah. It's recent enough, because like we said, it ended 10 years ago, so it started, what, 14 years ago? 13? 14? Because we're in 2258 now. So, yeah, looking at it in that context with that neighborhood, a lot of our characters will remember it. But, you know, if they're in their 20s, they would not have been an active participation.
Mm.
But most of our cast are 30s or 40s, which you should probably point out is kind of unusual for a sci-fi show, even though when JMS is responding to people online saying, you know, why don't you have any younger people? And he's like, because this is a military outfit and it takes time to reach these ranks.
Mm-hmm.
You have to get promoted to this point. So.
And TV dramas do tend to cast young, younger than is sometimes believable. But yeah, this is a lot of our characters are career military, so they need to be in their 40s or more.
Yeah, this isn't like the 80s when a bunch of ad execs said, well, 30-something is a huge drama. We should do something competitive that's a comedy. So they called in a woman who had a track record for making a lot of great sitcoms and said, hey, can you make a sitcom about an older generation of women? And she came back with The Golden Girls.
Mm.
But the 20-something execs were picturing 30-something women.
She made the right choice.
She did. She didn't realize they were looking for 30-somethings until she showed them the pilot. And they're like, okay, you know what? We'll make this anyway.
The other part about that conversation with Delenn and Franklin is that Franklin returns the question, what did you do during the war? And Delenn's like, yeah, that's a topic for another time, because I totally like gray counseled, shadow manipulated, government personed the war. It's one of those, I watched it happen, I made it happen kind of things that she's just not going to confess up to yet. Or that's how I read it.
Okay, yeah, she's definitely holding back.
Yeah.
Again, tipping for our giving form to the dream section, we will know exactly what Delenn was doing throughout the course of the war by the time this series is finished.
Yeah, I imagine it's one of those things they're intentionally teasing us about, but They don't want to say, yeah, because it's only episode 8 or whatever episode it is.
Yeah. They raise it up just to get people thinking about it. Get them going, oh yeah, what was she doing?
As we were going through his dreams, Sinclair's dreams, it wasn't immediately clear that this was the Battle of the Line. It felt like it probably could be, but didn't have to be. And I don't know if they should have broadcast that more ahead of time, or just the way it played out and letting you figure things out as you go was the better choice. But there's not enough information in his first flashbacks to tell you this is definitely the Battle of the Line.
No, but there's no question by the end of the episode, so...
Definitely.
Yeah, I think playing it this way doesn't just work to help keep the audience engaged when you see the same flashback a little bit longer and a little bit longer and a little bit longer. If you know too much the first time, you can get bored with it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also keeping in with the tone of the show, where they're going to be asking questions early and answering them much later on.
Oh, the Babylon 5 officers have a little gray piece of metal on the back of their hand. And it's just kind of there, and it's just part of their look. And it's explicitly shown here for the first time that I noticed that that is a removable adhesive communicator. And like, they can take it off their hand and put it back on their hand, but that's how they communicate. You know, instead of having like the touch badge on their chest, like on Star Trek, it's something like a Dick Tracy wristwatch, but it's an adhesive on your command, on your back of your hand. And I had not noticed that before this episode.
Okay. It actually had come up earlier when Sinclair reconnects with Catherine Sakai in Parliament of Dreams. He takes it off and shoves it in his pants pocket when people are talking to him.
Okay.
Yeah, and then Catherine says, your pants are talking to you.
That's right. I remember that your pants are talking to you. I don't remember seeing him take it off, but I believe you.
Yeah, they didn't make a super big deal of it. He just kind of pulls it off and slips it in the pocket. But yeah, it does happen on screen. It's just not where your attention is necessarily focused in that moment.
Right, which is, you know, it's one of those possibly deliberate, possibly passive choices that was made. This is a normal part of their attire. This is as significant as their socks. It's just there. You don't necessarily have to draw attention to the fact, hey, I have this communicator on the back of my hand. So, like, you, as you're slowly watching, you're beginning to realize what the different aspects of the thing are.
Mm-hmm.
I was really surprised at how empty that station felt. We have never seen it look this empty. It's a city. It's a small city in space, and there are always people in the corridors, people walking by, people in the rooms. So whenever he wakes up and it's abandoned, it felt creepy. They've just done a really good job making this feel like a large lived-in environment.
Yeah, they have done that really nicely. And like you said, it's not necessarily obvious until you have that contrast,
mm-hmm.
especially that main corridor. So that main corridor, that large hallway where you can start to see some of the curvature of the station, that is actually the only standing set. Everything else is what they call a fold and hold. So they can take any set apart, store it, and then put it back up quickly.
Okay, I was kind of wondering about, because we've seen quite a number of locales on the station. Interesting. The newspaper had some interesting headlines.
Yes. Yep, virtually all of which are foreshadowing.
I imagine that they were either foreshadowing or tying into something that we've seen a little bit of already. To give context, the first scene that we see of the station after Sinclair's VR situation begins, Garibaldi is reading the paper and Delenn walks in on him and he folds it. And I paused and wrote down all of the headlines. So should I run through these for the listeners?
Please do.
Okay. So you let me know if you can say anything about any of these as we go. So first one, pros and cons of interspecies mating. Marsupials definitely have the right idea on child rearing, say some. I don't know about marsupials. We already talked about interspecies mating and how there's like guidelines on the station.
Yes, and that's a concept that will be returned to.
Okay, okay. The Narns settle the Ragesh 3 controversy. Now, this is a callback to that diplomatic argument between the Centauri and the Narns that was basically a background plot point to let the new aides have time on TV.
I thought that was the Euphrates Treaty and Ragesh 3 was Binet on the firing line.
Oh, okay. I could be getting my plot points confused. Oh, that's right. Ragesh 3, that was the station that got attacked at the beginning. Yeah.
Yes, that is the one from Midnight on the Firing Line.
Okay. So it was a Centauri station. The Narns attacked it and then tried to cover it up. And yeah, that led to some reinforcements of our ideas that Jakar was a big bad, because he was definitely being a big bad in that episode. One of the headlines says, Psi-Corp in election tangle. Did Psi-Corp violate its charter by endorsing the vice president?
Yeah, so that, you know, Psi-Corp is not supposed to take sides in politics. And in the last election, they did. But notice that the one they endorsed was the vice president and not the president.
Right.
That plot thread is not done either.
There is a partial headline, something about a star discovered on the bottom. This one I didn't write all of. I think I was going to try to get the letters clear, and then I got frustrated because I kept not timing the pause right. Something guard leader convicted. Something stir found guilty in attack on Minbari embassy.
Okay.
We may not have enough to know what that's about.
Yeah, that one I don't recall. Okay. I didn't get a good look at the newspaper itself, but I was reading a lot of the Astron answers when people were on the Usenet forums going, you know, is this relevant? Is this relevant? Is this relevant? And Jameis is going, yep.
That's all there.
Yeah, so there should be at least one more.
I've got four more, actually. Copyright trial continues in Book Zap Flap. Books downloaded directly into Brain. Who owns them? I don't know if that would play into the storyline, but it's a very cool future sci-fi headline.
Yeah, and that one is, I think it's not really a future storyline so much as world building, because it lets you know that, you know, 5 years prior to The Matrix, we had a sci-fi show where you could download knowledge directly into people's brains.
Yeah.
Which I don't recall if it's ever addressed on screen, but in the Ask and Answered as part of the backstory that he's answering online, at least when it was answered, he hadn't found a good way to get it on screen. That's how all these ambassadors learned English, with the exception of Kosh.
Oh, by having the language beamed into their heads?
Yeah. So the three major languages in the international commerce are English on Babylon 5, because it's an Earth station, Interlac, which is kind of like a galactic Esperanto designed to be easy for everyone to learn, and Centauri, because they had been dominant for so long.
Does the name Interlac have its roots in some place other than the Legion of Superheroes? Because that's where I've most heard it. But it seems like the sort of thing that maybe Asimov came up with that just got used by other sci-fi writers.
I honestly don't know.
I'm curious. Okay, so San Diego is still considered too radioactive for occupancy. Study published by the Earth Force Nuclear Advisory Office declares San Diego, struck by American state's first act of nuclear terror years ago, still uninhabitable for...
Yeah, that is part of the world building that they've done. They mentioned the terrorist bombing of San Diego as a previous tragedy.
Right.
So staying consistent.
Oh, and the Earth Force, those are the racist Earth First people.
No, that's Home Guard. Earth Force is the combined military that all the Babylon 5 personnel work for.
Oh, my bad. Okay, so Earth Force is just, okay, just the military, gotcha. I guess an analog to Starfleet. And finally, President promises recent budget by, and I think it was cut off. And those are all the headlines that I got.
Okay, there was some feedback on another one with the idea of things living in hyperspace as well.
I didn't even see that one. Okay, things living in hyperspace. You know, we jumped through hyperspace to get to and from this station. Seems like that might be an important idea.
Yeah, that's how they accomplish faster than light travel. So interstellar systems need hyperspace to function.
And if there are creatures living on that dimensional level or whatever, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a whole lot of other notes. So whenever Sinclair defrocks one of the Great Council members, we don't initially see that it's Delenn. But my brain said, oh, that's Delenn, isn't it? And then later on, he looks back at the same scene and we see Delenn with the silver triangle on her forehead that she doesn't normally wear. So it's not a permanent marking, but it is how we can recognize Great Council members. And so at the end of the episode, when another Great Council member shows up, he has the silver triangle on his forehead as well.
Yeah, and like you said, they don't tell us immediately it's Delenn, but it's not a tough blank to fill in. We already know she's a Satai, and that's a member of the Great Council. Right? He's put that together in an earlier episode. He, like you said, he recognizes that Great Council member. So yeah, it's not really confirmed until the end.
Mm-hmm.
But seriously, if it's going to be a big shock that Sinclair recognizes them, at this point, you expect the audience to recognize them too, because they don't have a lot of room for backstory. You say, oh yeah, I know them from this and this and this. So it's either going to be Delenn or Lanier.
Right.
And obviously Delenn would have a little more impact than Lanier, and makes more sense knowing that she is Satai, and we know that she's a member of the Great Council, which is why Lanier didn't even want to make direct eye contact, which tells you he's at a lower station than a member of the Great Council. So, yeah, so there's really only two options, and one is far more likely.
And just one thought I had is that probably when those events actually happened, he would not have known Delenn at that time. But now that he's looking back at that memory from his present-day perspective, he's able to see the face and the memory and go, oh, I know who that is, because I know her now.
It's an interesting connection. There's also probably a couple of things we should note on the production side before we go on too much further.
Mm-hmm.
This was the sixth episode produced of the season, even though it aired eighth.
Okay.
And the role of Knight 2 that went to Christopher Neame, who, you know, he was in License to Kill as Fallon, he was in The Prestige, he was actually in Ghostbusters 2 as the maitre d', for another Ghostbusters reference. That role was originally intended for Walter Koenig, but he ended up having a heart attack and getting the surgery for it. So they had to reschedule him, but they still wanted to use him. So that's one that probably worked out well, because Bester comes back a lot more than Knight 2 does.
Yeah, this definitely brings an end to Knight 2's story, apparently, in a way that I would not have wanted to see for Bester, because leaving Bester as a possibly returning threat, I feel like works well for him. Yeah, I forgot to mention where the actors are from. So Knight 1, I recognized from two Star Trek appearances. He is Khan's son, Joachim, in The Wrath of Khan. Well, maybe not biological son, but he plays like a son. He's one of the other genetically engineered people that Khan is very fond of. And then he was also in a first season episode of Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah, he was also in the V TV series, the Blade film, and he was the character Absalom in three episodes of The X-Files in seasons 8 and 9.
And if you're a fan of V, there is a podcast out there done by the Fire and Water Network called Once Upon a Geek. And back in 2022, Shag did a three-episode series on V. So recommend going and checking that out.
Yeah, it should be easy to find. That's how he launched the podcast.
Right. It's like one of the earliest episodes.
Yes. It's well done. I sent him some feedback and also a link to the V Commodore 64 game that he was aware of but had never played.
All right.
Turns out it's abandonware, so it's out there and playable in multiple forms.
That is fun. The Earth-Minbari collusion that is brought up seems like a story idea that we're definitely going to come back to, so we can talk about that more in a minute. But the end, whenever Knight 2 is saying, maybe you're still inside. So I read that as a couple things. It could be paranoia about still being connected to the cybernetic reality, but it seemed like there was a pretty obvious double entendre that Sinclair is still connected to the Minbari somehow, that he's still inside that situation in some way that is yet to be discussed further.
Yeah, that's not far off the mark.
So anyways, those were all of my thoughts on the episode. You have anything else before we move on to Shadows and Portents?
Yeah, I think most of the of those foreshadows are the giving form to the dream, the stuff that's coming up. We've covered most of them. We should do our last best hope before I fill in the last couple of blanks.
Right.
Of the foreshadowing that is happening here.
Okay, so what is your last best hope for this episode?
Let me think. Oh, I'm actually thinking of it now. I missed another production thing that's worth bringing up. So I'll relay that production trivia. During some of these effects in the hallucinatory world, they do some optical effects with the lenses.
Mm-hmm.
They had actually tried to rent a specific lens called the Mesmerizer to do this. Only the company that they were renting it from accidentally rented out the one that they had prepaid for to another production.
Oh.
So, earlier in the season, I mentioned that JMS liked people with stage credits and liked people who can improvise and make do. Director of photography John Flynn came back to the set, went right to the craft services table. Craft services is where all the food comes from. So meals, but snacks during the day as well. Went through their table, found a glass pretzel bowl, dumped the pretzels, cleaned it out, and used that as the lens.
It's just shaped glass, right? So it works. I like it. That's pretty great.
Yes, so this was filmed through a pretzel bowl.
Now, I want to know if they got refunded for their prepaid lens they got denied them on the day. That seems like that's where they should get their money back for.
Yeah, I want to know both that and who they accidentally sold it or rented it to instead.
Right.
But yeah, because Hollywood is notorious for backdoor deals and things like that. I have a friend who knows people who were in the TV stations in Florida when this was airing, and they were, or he's under the impression, and I'll say that this friend, I don't want to name him on air, because
obviously
if he says it, if he says it, he believes it, but it is hearsay. So he says his friends in the TV industry told him that the Paramount reps were basically threatening stations that if you chose to take or to air Babylon 5, you would be denied Deep Space Nine and Voyager, which is illegal and could have been reported, but then it turns into a he said, she said thing.
Right.
So,
well, that's unfortunate.
That's part of the reason I'm wondering, well, who had the lens and why did they do it? So
I see. Yeah.
My friend said that. I'm not going to name him because he's actually been doxxed by people just because he irritated them.
Well, you don't want to name people on situations like this. That's fine.
Yeah. Especially someone who's already had SWAT teams show up at their door because he corrected them on biblical knowledge. Because he knows more details about the Bible than most people, and a lot of people believe in what they feel is in the Bible, and when he said that, that's not actually what it said, they got upset and doxed him.
Oh.
So.
Humans are fun.
Yeah. At times, yes. So. Anyway. Now, I'm not saying that the bigwigs at Paramount were supporting that. That sounds like the kind of crap a salesperson might do
right
on their own. But anyway, apparently that was happening. So, and that's part of why I was standing out, because to me, that's a level of improvisation to get the show done and dedication that kind of stands out. So that's actually where my mind was going to.
That can be your nomination, yeah.
Because that's just the level of production and craft it takes to put the show together on the budget they had. Because the budget was not huge. Apparently, they made this entire season of Babylon 5 for less money than it cost to make the pilot episode of Voyager. So, you know, you can watch it and see, yeah, they don't have Voyager money, but when you realize how big that difference is, that says so much about the production staff putting it together.
That first episode of Voyager landing on the planet, I imagine, was a pretty big money suck to make that look real and believable. I contend that the first episode of Voyager is a pretty solid episode, maybe the strongest episode of that first season. It certainly sets an expectation higher for the series than it ends up meeting, in my estimation, as that first season goes on.
I would even say that the pilot episode of Voyager might be the strongest episode of its first three seasons. It is a really rock-solid pilot.
Yeah, yeah.
Generally speaking, there's like four or five Star Trek series I like better than Voyager, but that pilot is almost untouchable.
But not being a Star Trek podcast, so there is a scene early in the VR situation, which is part of how they establish to Sinclair that this is just a simulation in his mind, where Garibaldi, and it's immediately after the scene where Garibaldi and Delenn realize the commander's missing and Garibaldi goes off to find him. We cut back to the VR and Garibaldi walks in and says, "Hey, I was looking all over for you, Commander." And Knight 2 shoots him. And then Garibaldi walks in front of the hallway. "Commander, how's it going? Commander, Commander, how you doing, Commander?" And between that scene saying Commander like 25 times in the space of 30 seconds, and then just since a lot of the dialogue is directed to and about Commander Sinclair, the word Commander is said so many times in this episode that I want to snarkily give last best hope to just the word Commander. Because if they're paid by the number of times they use it, then man, they got their money's worth this time. But I think I'm going to instead give the last best hope to the reveal of Delenn. I feel like that was a linchpin moment for at least where we have come to in the season. Sinclair's and Delenn's relationship has been one of the cornerstone relationships of the show. And even though it's not always a plot point for an episode, it's one of those things that you know is there. And it was established very strongly in the pilot. And so now knowing that Sinclair full on is aware that Delenn has more going on than she really should have in her current position. I'm very curious to see what's going to develop between those two. And the fact that Delenn may suspect, but can't be fully certain that Sinclair remembers anything. She is sort of dependent upon the fact that he doesn't. So the fact that he does, lots of stuff going on there. So that revelation of that connection is my last best hope for this episode.
Yeah, I can see that, because I suspect that's why you remembered as though you'd watched the entire first season and said this has kind of that season finale energy, was that reveal. Knowing what's coming in the season, this would be small for a season finale. Yes, we have major revelations in terms of the relationship between Sinclair and Delenn, but that only has, it's got a major impact on Sinclair and a minor impact on Delenn, who apparently remembers it all.
Mm-hmm.
And those are really the only two characters that are significantly touched in this episode, which is what makes it small on the Babylon 5 season finale scale.
Right. It's worth pointing out, in case it hasn't been clear in our discussion, that almost this is a very small cast episode. Most of our regulars don't show up.
Yeah, we don't have any ambassadors other than Delenn and none of their assistants.
Right.
When we get to the actual season finales, it's going to be like all hands on deck.
Right.
So I'm actually really looking forward to hearing your feedback on some of the episodes we have coming.
Yeah, the season is roughly more or less split into thirds in the way it was broadcast. So even though I said at the beginning of the episode that this has like mid-season finale energy, it's more like 1A out of B and C, the chunks of the season. So it's I'm curious to see how the structure and the storytelling goes as we go through the second group of episodes into TKO, and then the third group of episodes into the, I believe you once said, unintentionally delayed season finale.
Yeah, we can talk about how P10 chose to schedule it when it comes.
Gotcha. All right, so that being our last best hope, let's move into giving form to the dream. Now, this is where, if you're a new listener, we fully believe in no spoilers for future events as we go through this podcast. However, I, as a first-time viewer of a large world-building show or other franchise, I've always found interesting to be able to put a pin in elements that are worth paying attention to. So we're not going to give information about what happens later, but things in this episode that you want to keep in the back of your head for later. So things I mentioned earlier were the Earth-Minbari collusion allegations, that maybe there's something going on between the governments at the end of that war. Of course, all the stuff between Sinclair and Delenn holds portents for the future. And like you said, the stuff in those headlines might be important. But what are some other things that we should definitely not forget in this episode?
We've touched on most of them. They're pretty obvious. The only other sort of foreshadowing that's a little bit subtle is that in his hallucination, when Sinclair is being taken to the interrogation, he asks a few questions, only one of which echoes. So the question, "What do you want?" really resonates.
And that's a question directed to the Minbari who have him prisoner?
That's right, yeah. And he says, "What do you want?" It resonates in that room.
Okay. All right. So I guess I already figured out all the other stuff that seemed portentous.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. So.
Okay. Normally you have several more points. I didn't mean to steal all your thunder this time.
That's okay, because in this one, often the foreshadowing in this is very subtle. I think the subtle stuff was the echoing and the newspaper headlines. The rest is not so much a subtle foreshadowing as, no, this is ongoing story. We're just telling the next part. So that's going to happen. We're going to get the arc episodes. The giving form to the dream is going to be a lot more obvious, because they're not hiding things in plain sight. They're just flat out saying this is happening.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, as we get closer and closer to the end of the series, we're not going to have as much there because, you know, that the story is wrapping up and there's nothing left to foreshadow.
Gotcha. All righty. Well, we're coming up to an interesting point in the production of this podcast, because as we said, there is a broadcast break after this episode. Next episode, Deathwalker, was released on April 20th, 1994. So our next regular episode of the podcast will be on April 20th, 2024. But rather than leave a gulf of 4 weeks with no episode, we decided that during these broadcast breaks, we are going to do a less frequent release schedule of specials. Since we only have a month between now and next episode, we're just going to do one special, and that is a feedback special. We have not responded to any of your feedback because A, this is the past. You haven't sent it yet. But also B, we wanted to kind of clump it all together. So we are going to be recording our feedback special early in the morning on April 6th. So if you have not yet sent in your letters or comments or thoughts on the show, try to get them in by the April 5th so we can do that recording on the 6th. And then in your podcatcher feed, we will have a feedback special released on April 13th, which is, of course, the week before our next regular episode coverage.
Yeah, so there is that 1 week delay because John and I are both teachers by day, and we need time to do the editing.
Teachers by day, superheroes by night. It's a busy life.
Yeah, see, I just do the teacher by day thing. I'm not the superhero by night because your planet's yellow sun doesn't let me use my other superpowers.
I'm sorry. I can't control the sun, dude. We've talked about this. Stop blaming me. But speaking of feedback, Blaine, how can they get in touch with us?
Well, one way is to send email to Babylon5 30 years later at gmail.com using numerals or words for the numbers, your choice. We've captured all four of those email addresses.
You can also leave comments at either of the two websites where this show is hosted, the first of which is my website that has all of my various podcasts, including this one, and that is johnreadscomics.com. There is no H in John. Just go there, find the episode posting, and leave a comment.
You can also leave comments at bureau42.com, and those, unless you specify otherwise, can be read on the air as well.
If you send us a review, we will happily thank you with all of our hearts and read your review on the air. We check Apple Podcasts regularly for reviews. If you leave a review through some other podcatcher medium, send us a note somehow, some way, if you would like us to thank you and sing your praises on the air.
And finally, we will also accept comments on the YouTube posts that go along with all of our episodes, since we are posting these on YouTube with a variety of organized playlists.
And we always like to close the episode with a podcast promo to tell you about another show. This is a segment that we call the Zocalo, where everybody comes together for their, you know, drinks and social time. And we're going to socialize with some of the podcasts. So, Blaine, what is our podcast promo for this week?
So this one is one of the shows that I am doing. It's Bedtime in the Public Domain, which has been a little sporadic since the baby was born. But there's a number of books and stories that are in the public domain that are just being read in that podcast. So I've done most of the reading. John has stepped in, and he read The Eagle's Shadow in one of our earlier topics as well. So you could check those out. There's a lot of children's literature, because that's how it started, but it's been branching out since then. So now we've got some H.G. Wells, some Jules Verne, in addition to, you know, a lot of Frank Baum's Oz novels, both of the Alice in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll, a.k.a. Charles Lutwidge Dodson, the mathematician who did some significant work with matrices in the days.
And it's worth pointing out that it's called Bedtime in the Public Domain because these are all works in the public domain. So we can do these audio releases for works that are no longer legally retained by their writers.
That is correct. And I am watching carefully for the days when some of the others drop into the public domain. And I'm looking for things that are public domain in both US and Canada. So, for example, at the time of this recording, there's about 6 or 7 Agatha Christie novels that are in the public domain in the US, because US goes, I think it's 95 years after publication, whereas Canada public domain rules say it's life plus 50, so 50 years after the death of the author. So you guys will have, you know, a good 50 or 60 years of Agatha Christie novels dropping into the public domain one at a time, whereas in Canada we get the whole load on, I think, January 1st, 2028. So in any event, some of Agatha Christie's early works, once public domain in both countries, will be showing up there and so forth.
We're still going to be doing this podcast then, I just realized.
We are, yeah. And I do plan to also do readings of some of the works that JMS has said inspired him that are in the public domain. You know, things like Mark Twain. There's a couple of specific Mark Twain stories that he keeps directing people to when I'm reading these old Usenet posts. So those will show up. They might show up as specials in the broadcast breaks, like the one that's coming. Don't want to commit to that at this point because I don't know when I'll have a chance to read them And I will probably be cross-posting those with Bedtime in the Public Domain. So I need to make sure the schedule works for both. But I think that about wraps us up. So when we come back, as John said, get your feedback in by April 5th to be included in our April 13th feedback episode. And then on Saturday, April 20th, we will discuss Deathwalker. So if Michael Bailey is listening, this is going to be an easy one for your It All Comes Back to Superman, given one of the guest stars.
Hey. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you in, I believe it's 3 weeks for feedback and 4 weeks for more Babylon 5. Thanks for listening, everyone.
And good eating to you.
Hi, I'm Blaine Dowler, host of Bedtime in the Public Domain. In this podcast series, I'll read bedtime stories from books in the public domain. Each weekday, I'll release one chapter or short story from a selected larger collection. Once the entire book is done, I'll also release an audiobook version, including all chapters or short stories, before taking a few days off to prepare the next series. All stories will be from one of the children's categories from the Project Gutenberg website, because they do an excellent job of vetting the content to ensure it's in public domain, and I have neither the time nor expertise required to do that myself. Suggestions for the stories that come next are welcome and encouraged. You can find the show at Bureau42.com, on iTunes, and on Stitcher.
Blaine, I'm going to take back some of the things I've said about you. Here's a candy bar. You've earned it.